Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how Chinese medicine has been shown to kill cancer cells, study at the University of Adelaide. Then we're going to look at being positive is linked to a lower chance of dying, from Oxford University. And a landmark study shows half of cancer patients are killed by chemotherapy, not cancer, from Claire Burnish of Freethought Project. And also today, our talkback issue will be on two levels. One is, what if everything we were told about ADHD and ADD were wrong? What if there is no brain chemical imbalance in your son or daughter, and you've been drugging him all this time? A whole nation of kids taking very powerful psychoactive drugs, right up there, class with heroin and cocaine. So what would we do? What could we do? What should we do? Who says this? Oh, you'll find that out. A rather renowned Harvard psychologist says ADHD is largely a fraud. From Caroline Wright, Wake Up World. And today, we're also from our audio file, we're going to play you a clip. And this clip is going to be a part two of a four-part series of an ex-Israeli soldier. And I'm playing this for a simple reason. If we watched this man and actually saw footage each night, let's say when we're watching the news, and we saw 10 to 12 minutes of his experience as being an Israeli trained soldier whose father's head of the police, whose mother's a top official in the Israeli military, and he is a hardline Zionist. And then something happens, and his whole construct, psychological construct, begins to change. Would that impact us? Would the Israeli Palestinians, would we seek a different type of order, a different type of peace process? Would we be at all more humanistically aligned with those who are suffering on both sides of the issue? So we're going to hear part two of that today. And I don't know if time permits for anything else, but we'll give it to you as we get it. So the Chinese have been using combinations, and more often than not, when you go to a Chinese shop down in a little Chinatown, or you see a Chinese physician, they don't give you one thing. They give you a combination. And generally, it's a series of powders where you, if you're in their shop, you'll see them take different pieces of roots and leaves and twigs, whatever it might be, sea vegetation, and they grind it up, and then they put it into a powder and tell you how to take it. That's a little challenging for American science because we only identify one active element at a time. But that gets away from the whole concept of synergy. For example, one good example would be when you take vitamin C intravenous, but you also put in glutathione in the same bag so it goes into the person's body, you get a much more profound effect of both the glutathione and the vitamin C than if you gave each separately. So it's all about the synergy. Now, this is in the University of Adelaide, very respected institution. Here's what they say. I'll quote them. Researchers at University of Adelaide have shown how a complex mix of plant compounds derived from ancient clinical practice in China, a traditional Chinese medicine, works to kill cancer cells. Compound cushion injection, or what is called CKI, is approved for use in China to treat various cancers, tumors. But how it works has not been known. This study, published in the journal Oncotarget, is one of the first to characterize the molecular action of a traditional Chinese medicine rather than breaking down to its constituent parts. Quote, most traditional Chinese medicines are based on hundreds or thousands of years of experience with their use in China. This is the professor, Adelson, who directed the study. There is often plenty of evidence that these medicines have a therapeutic benefit, but there isn't the understanding of how or why. We broke down and tested the compounds of many traditional Chinese medicines. We would find that individual compounds don't have much activity on their own. It's the combination of compounds which can be effective and potentially means few side effects as well. This is one of the first studies to show the molecular mode of action of a complex mixture of plant-based compounds, in this case extracts from the roots of medicinal herbs. Anyhow, I share this with you simply because sometimes people say, well, what is better, Gary? Is it better to have blueberries or blackberries? Is it better that I have celery juice or cucumber juice? And we still have this idea that we should be thinking in the monotheistic concept. I say, combine it all. The more that you combine, for example, the more nutrients, if you combine coenzyme Q10 with vitamin E and NADH with cayenne and magnesium and calcium with potassium and hawthorn, then what you have is you have a beautiful combination, synergistic combination to prevent a heart attack or stroke, to keep your blood naturally thinned, to save lives. But in our thinking, we only think of, tell me which one I should take. And what I'm sharing is, it's the synergy. They work better when taken all together. And if I were to give you a lemon juice in the morning, that would be good. 1 ounce of lemon juice diluted in 8 to 12 ounces of water. Always be aware, dental enamel can erode if you don't practice proper hygiene after drinking something very acidic. And I know a lot of people suck on oranges. You really shouldn't be doing that at all because you're going to rot your teeth. It's going to destroy your enamel. But in any case, 1 ounce of ginger juice is phenomenal for your health, your immune system, your intestines. But so is garlic. Now, if you were to take garlic, onion, and ginger together, 1 ounce of each, and put it in 16 ounces of green apple, celery, and cucumber juice, now you've got a phenomenal combination. It's going to kill cancer cells. It's going to kill bacteria and viruses in your throat like strep and staph. It's going to recolonize your gut. It's going to help you with digestion. So you see, combinations are the key. And that study from the University of Adelaide, just it's nice to see that they're thinking synergistically, because Ayurvedic, Indian healing, traditional bush culture, medicine, it's all combinations. From the University of Helsinki, midlife physical activity is associated with a better cognition in old age. Now, this was a Finnish twin cohort study. It's a long-term study, and they looked at everything. They looked at whether you have high blood pressure, you smoked, your education level, your sex, your obesity, binge drinking, you name it, and they looked at all that, and then they said, what single thing will give you the best opportunity to keep your brain healthy? And they found that it was exercise. Exercise was the single most important thing you could do in your mid-30s up to about 50 in order to have a healthier brain and body later in life. So get out there and power walk, bike, but you got to do it at least 6 days a week and ideally an hour a day. And for those of you who have been using probiotics, and I hope you do it daily, this is from a new study published in the Journal of Microbiology and Biotechnology, and it found that Lactobacillus plantarum, that's a simple supplement, it's a probiotic, it actually helps boost skin elasticity and reduces wrinkles in women with dry skin. So, for women who have problems with their skin, probiotics can make a big difference. University of Oxford, they did a study on being positive. If you're positive, does it lower your chance of dying? And the answer is yes. They looked at 28,662 people, and they looked, followed their level of happiness, and this is part of the British Sociological Association's Medical Sociological Conference, and they found that those people who were positive in their mental attitude had a relatively low risk of dying, 18% lower in a four-year follow-up period if you were positive. So just imagine what that would mean over a person's lifetime. You could add years and years to your life if you just keep a positive attitude. And so think, everything we experience in life is just information. It's how we process the information. Now, if you're a highly conditioned individual, if you start off with some traumas and some unknowns from your parents and grandparents, meaning anything that might have been volatile or non-constructive or non-spiritual that's passed through into the gene, that means that it's there. The key is what activates it. You know, it's a door with a lock. You have to put the key in. And if you misinterpret current events, how someone speaks with you, what's happening in the world, what you can control or not control on a daily basis, all that can impact whether or not one day you put the right key in that lock and it opens up and all this negativity comes out. Now you can't control it. Now you get caught up into a negative cycle, a loop, and you just keep going on and on in this loop until one day you look in the mirror and you're just a mess. You're just one big, giant train wreck. And that's what we do. And then we have industries, big industries, powerful industries, wealthy industries come in and say, I'm Dr. Schmuck, and I want to help you by selling you some worthless drugs. Now, don't worry, the drugs can cure nothing. They've never been shown to cure anything, and you're going to be on them the rest of your life. And at some point, you're probably going to be on 15 because everyone you're going to see is going to give you another Dr. Schmuck drug. But we're all making money from it, and thank you, you're helping us move to a better neighborhood. And that's the way it works. Anyone who believes otherwise is being extremely naive. So what if you just decided, hey, it's just information, and I'm choosing not to get angry about it. I'm choosing not to get upset. I've got a whole life to live. I'm not going to be living it always with some negative projection, some fatalistic construct. So having a positive disposition can make a difference. And by the way, they also measured in for religious beliefs and income, and that did not at all impact a person's life span. But being positive did. Also, there's new evidence that what you eat will make a definite difference in macular degeneration that affects the tissue of the eye and is responsible for central vision. And, quote, some studies have shown that people who eat dark, leafy green vegetables like spinach, kale, broccoli, and collard greens have a lower risk and of macular degeneration. There is lutein in these foods, and lutein is concentrated in the retina and the macula of the eye. It's responsible for absorbing the blue part of the light spectrum, which ultimately protects the retina from light damage. And this was part of the National Institutes of Health's age-related eye disease study. So, your grandmother was right all along. Eat your greens and have better vision. One last thing here. A study published in Biofactors, quote, high-dose coenzyme Q10 supplementation may improve wrinkles around the eyes and other parts of the face. And the scientists in Slovenia gave 150 milligrams per day of coenzyme Q10 for 12 weeks, and that was associated with reduced wrinkles around the eyes and around the mouth and the lips compared to the placebo that had no impact. So they had two different amounts. The one amount was 50 milligrams a day. That was called a low dose. And the other was 150 milligrams. They called that a high dose. I would call 150 milligrams a low dose. And if you did that 3 times a day, then, wow, your skin should look awful smooth. I'm Gary Nall. One more thing we're going to take a look at, and this is our issue of the day, and I'm going to ask you to call in and share your talk back on it. From Carolina Wright. Viewed by academics as one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century, Jerome Kagan ranked above Carl Jung, by the way, he was the founder of analytical psychology, and Dr. Ivan Pavlov, he's the discoverer of the Pavlovian reflex, in a 2002 American Psychological Association ranking of the most eminent psychoanalysts and psychologists. He's also well known for his pioneering work in developing psychology at Harvard University, where he has spent decades documenting how babies and small children grow, and is an exceptional and highly regarded researcher. So it may be surprising to learn that he believes the diagnosis of ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is an invention and only benefits the pharmaceutical industry and the psychiatrist. Quote from him, Dr. Jerome Kagan, "That is the history of humanity. Those in authority believe they're doing the right thing, and they harm those who have no power." Yep. And then in an interview with Spiegel, the German magazine, Dr. Kagan addressed the skyrocketing rates of ADHD in America, which he attributes to, quote, fuzzy diagnostic practices. He illustrated his point with the following example. Say, 50 years ago, you have a 7-year-old who was bored at school and exhibits disruptive behavior. Back then, he would be labeled as lazy. But today, that same child is said to suffer from ADHD. That's why we've seen such a dramatic increase in this disorder. Every child is having problems in school and is sent to see a pediatrician, who then claims it's ADHD and prescribes. In fact, 5.4 million kids have abnormal dopamine metabolism. The problem is, if a drug is available to doctors, they'll make the corresponding diagnosis. We could get philosophical and ask ourselves, what does mental illness mean? If you do an interview with children and adolescents aged 12 to 19, then 40% can be categorized as anxious or depressed. But if you take a closer look and ask how many of them are seriously impaired by this, the risk shrinks to 8%. Describing every child who is depressed or anxious is ridiculous. Adolescents are normal. They don't know what college is to go to. Their boyfriend or girlfriend just stood them up. Being sad or anxious is just as much a part of life as anger or sexual frustration. End quote. That was Dr. Kagan to Der Spiegel. Now, what are the implications for the millions of American children who are inaccurately diagnosed as mentally ill? Kagan believes it's devastating because they think there's something fundamentally wrong with them, and he's not the only psychologist to raise the alarm about this trend. But Dr. Kagan and others feel they're up against an enormously powerful alliance, pharmaceutical companies that are making billions in a profession that is self-interested. Kagan himself suffered from inner restlessness and stuttering as a child, but his mother told him, "There's nothing wrong with you. Your mind is working faster than your tongue." He thought at the time, "Gee, that's great. I'm only stuttering because I'm so smart." If he had been born in the present era, most likely he'd be classified as mentally ill. So here is my question. This is one of the most respected, renowned psychologists on the planet. Did you hear about this? Why did he have to go to Germany and do an interview with Der Spiegel? Why couldn't this have been a mainstream story on 60 Minutes or on Dateline or 2020 or the New York Times? Because then you would be adversely affecting the marketing of a whole class of drugs to kids, and it's multiple billions of dollars a year. So what if they had to acknowledge there is no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance? And by the way, we prove that in my new documentary. Where do you see it? Where do you see the undercover footage? And you see 12 of the leading board-certified professors of psychiatry, all diagnose a completely normal person, and within 2.5 to 5 minutes, give them a diagnosis that was wrong, give them a drug that they didn't need, and then when confronted on the street later, simply say, well, it's all subjective. Well, if subjective, I didn't give them a placebo for sugar pill. Sugar pill's not going to kill them. This could cause suicidal tendencies or actual case of suicide. They just shrug their shoulders. There's not a single article in the scientific literature in the world they have to support their position. And yet they continue to do it. That is how bad psychiatry has become. And that's how vulnerable our children are. And that's how susceptible parents of those children are to be indoctrinated into what I discussed earlier in this week with some commentaries that I gave on comparing Orwell, George Orwell's 1984, with Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Orwell said we have an authoritarian regime that wants everyone to have a certain concept of truth, and you must live by that, and they must watch you at all times, 24/7. Huxley said you don't have to worry about the government watching you 24/7 because people want to show what they're doing 24/7. They're voluntarily giving away all their freedom. They're giving away all that is essential to critical thought. And they're both right. It's a combination of the two. So now imagine what it's like to be a parent today when there's so much conditioning for you to do the right thing, even when doing the right thing puts your child at risk. Your thoughts. How do you believe we should deal with the false diagnosing of a phantom disease that doesn't exist, ADHD, so that the pharmaceutical companies can make a profit? Our number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And we're going to take a brief break. Come right back. Please stay with us.
Daylight come and me want go home. Work all night and I drink a rum.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and me want go home.
Come.
Nice to have you with us. All over the world, people are listening. A big event, Sunday evening. I'm going to get my engineer to tell me whether it starts at 5 or 6 p.m., but it's 7-plus hours of new information from the world's leading scientists, engineers, and investigative journalists on the subject of... It starts at 6 p.m. I was just told 6 p.m. You can listen. I'm preparing for it now. And it's going to be a really terrific evening. So you can listen live. Just go to progressiveradionetwork.com on your computer. Or if you're out and about, just dial in. I'll give you a listen live number. Write it down, please. 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. But if you can't listen live and you're not at a computer, but you certainly want to download it, you can call the archives after the program, and it'll be uploaded, and that number is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Next week, I believe on Monday, I'll be doing an original in-depth investigative report, and it should be an important addition to our understanding of how we've been manipulated and lied to by the genetic engineering companies, just like Big Tobacco. I won't say more than that because it is really hard-hitting and should be newsworthy. Let's see if we can't get the major news people to cover it because it's all original. That'll be on Monday. Now we're going to go to a piece, part two, of a Israeli soldier. And he's speaking from his experience in his heart. And we rarely get to see this. We only get to see the pro-Netanyahu position. We only get to see those who consider all Palestinians a threat to their security. And if the goal is to bring peace to Israel, to bring peace to the Palestinian people and the Jewish community there, then we have to take a different approach. And these kind of stories then need to be heard. So let's now listen to part two of an Israeli soldier telling you what it's like to be in the midst of a war zone.
That I will understand that history is knocking on the door right now, and I'm on the wrong side. All of my life I was waiting to be on the right side, but I was on the wrong side all these months. And everything just snapped in my head, and I just had to shut myself down. I just shut myself down completely. My father, like many times before that, will call me and will tell me that the IDF spokesman talked about us, retrospective, after a few days. He will tell me that the IDF spokesman gave an announcement about our unit in Hebron. He said that our unit managed to kill the terrorist and to arrest another terrorist that tried to help him in his job in this weekend. And my mind was just not there anymore. And I just snapped. I closed up my head and continued to do my service. Day after day after day after day, continue to do the same thing. I will go into houses in the middle of the night. I will arrest people. I will arrest children, sometime under the age of 10 or 8, alone. I will arrest women and elderly people. I will shoot at protesters, live ammunition sometimes, rubber bullet or tear gas canister. I will do everything that I will be required in the next half a year, 6 months. I will just do everything like I'm supposed to. But when I'm starting to come home during the weekends, I understand that I cannot go back to be the same person I was. I understand that you cannot be the same person at home and a soldier at the army. You have to choose, and I, without no, chose that I'm a soldier. So I'm going back home, and I'm just not myself, and I'm literally could not recognize my face in the mirror. My mother is starting to tell me that I became a very violent man to them, to my parents. My girlfriend at the time is breaking up with me, and I'm completely on the edge. So I'm deciding to do something I didn't thought I will do. I'm taking my phone and I'm calling an old friend from back home. And we don't really like it because he's kind of a lefty friend. He's the leftiest friend of the group, and he's coming from a lefty family, so nobody really liked this guy. But I'm giving him a call. You know, and the only reason I really have his number is because he's, like, really good at basketball, so we keep in touch. So I'm calling my friend, and I'm telling him, man, you have to understand what I'm going through. I have to tell you. You're the only one who can listen to me. You're the only one I can think about calling. And my friend said, whoa, wait, what's going on? And I'm telling him, I have to tell you what I saw. And he's saying, okay, go. And I'm just starting telling this story and many else worst sometimes stories about the last 6 months of myself. And I'm telling him story by story by story. And at some point, my friend is telling me, whoa, okay, stop. Okay, listen, if you're really in such a bad shape, if you're really on the edge, if you really understand what's going down there, would you consider coming with me next Friday when you're leaving the base to a protest with anarchists against the wall in the village of Berlin? And I'm saying, whoa. Anarchists against the wall? Are you crazy? Anarchists? I don't know what anarchists are. It's crazy. People, no way. I'm out. I'm not going there. And he's saying, Iran, what do you got to lose? And I understand that I really don't have anything to lose at that moment. So I'm saying yes. And the next Friday I can, I'm leaving the base. Instead of going back to Jerusalem, I'm going to Tel Aviv. I'm putting my uniform in my civilian bag. I'm putting civilian clothes on me. And I find myself on a bus, of anarchists against the wall to the village of Berlin. The village of Berlin is a small village in the middle of Palestine that the separation wall is cutting the village in the middle, taking half of the land and half of the olive grove to the other side of the wall, just ruining the work and life of decades and just taking it to the other side of the wall. And since 2004, I think, the people of Berlin, it's exactly 9 years. It was this Friday, the last Friday was exactly 9 years to the protest. Every Friday, nonviolent protest, marches against the wall, against the soldier, against the occupation, marching to the wall, screaming to the soldier, leave our land, take with you your checkpoints, take with you your wall, and they're marching. And I'm getting into Berlin, and I'm scared shitless. I am so scared. I was never on a Palestinian ground, surrounded by Palestinians, without my M16, my two hand grenades, my 6 packs of ammunition, and my backup. Never. Everybody is talking in Arabic around me, and the only words I knew in Arabic was strip down and give me your ID. So I couldn't say that. So I was really stuck, in the middle of the village, very much afraid. And then the marching was starting. And back then it was still a fence. Today it's a 20-foot concrete wall. And they're starting to march into the fence. And there's some drummers, and there's some singing and some signs. And we're just marching. And I'm marching with them, and I'm so scared. And then in the corner of my eye, I see a few young men rising up and throwing some stones in the direction of the fence. And then immediately, 360 around us, we're surrounded by military army units all around us. The Israeli army is popping up and just start shooting, without saying a word, just start shooting into our body. And they're shooting rubber bullets, and I don't know if you ever know that, but rubber bullets are not rubber bullets. They're steel bullets with a little rubber around them. I didn't know that, and they're shooting rubber bullets into our body. They're shooting tear gas canisters into our body, and I was never shot at before. I shot at people before, but nobody ever shot at me, and I was so afraid that the only thing I could think about saying was just, stop shooting, I'm an Israeli soldier, stop shooting. Then one of the anarchist guys looking at me like this, saying, I'm an Israeli soldier too! You can stop shooting! And then a bunch of Palestinians are coming saying, we are all Israeli soldiers! You can stop shooting! I was not laughing because they didn't stop shooting. And then the tear gas started to kick in. And I don't know if you ever got tear gas. We tried it a little bit in boot camp, but it was nothing like that day in Berlin. The tear gas started to kick in, and tear gas basically just closes you up completely. You feel that you cannot breathe. It just chokes you up. You cannot take air inside. And until today, I'm not sure if tear gas is working here or it's working here, but it's working. And you feel that you cannot breathe. And my instinct was to try to run away from the gas, but just made it worse. So I find myself on four, in the middle of the village, trying to breathe, thinking, this is how I'm gonna die. And after a few moments, a few young Palestinian men just ran across from me, and one of them saw me, came back, and just grabbed me with him and ran with me into his home, in the village. He set me down in his home. He gave me some onion, apparently it's very good for that, and some alcohol pads, until I could feel that I breathe again. I went out of his house, back to my room, to this weekend, and I knew this is it for me. I will never go back to do the same things again, ever. But then Sunday came, and I'm taking off my uniform, and I'm taking my gun, and I'm going back to Hebron, because this is the only reality we know to be true in Israel. I didn't have any friends who didn't serve at this time. I didn't have any family member I can tell that I don't want to go back. So I'm going back, but this time I'm promising myself things will be different. And I'm continuing to go into protests with anarchists against the wall. And after a few weeks, they met me up in Tel Aviv with Doctors Without Borders. You know Doctors Without Borders? So they met me with the Israeli branch of Doctors Without Borders, and I will sit there, and they will ask for my help, and will explain to me the very specific situation in Doctors Without Borders, Israel. They'll tell me, you know, all the Palestinians in the West Bank, if they want to get to hospitals or get in medicine, get treatment, have to go through checkpoints into Israel proper or through the West Bank. They have checkpoints between their land to their land, and they have to go through it. And if they want to go through the checkpoints, they have to have permits from the military, humanitarian permits, to go to a hospital. And all of you, of course, know that the Israeli army is the most moral army in the world, right? So you know the Israeli army is already taking out the permits. It does. But instead of giving it to the sick Palestinians, it's giving it to the lawyers of Doctors Without Borders that are arresting them every day. And then all they need to do is to make sure that they don't let anyone from Doctors Without Borders or representative go through the checkpoints into the West Bank and give these permits into sick hands of Palestinians. And this is how the Israeli army is basically making sure, in a legal aspect, it is protected from every angle. Nobody can complain. During this time, my mother is dying out of cancer back home in Jerusalem. And I'm finding myself, in the next year and a half, sneaking out of my base in the middle of the night with my uniform and my vest and my gun, going into houses in the middle of Hebron and later on South Mount Hebron, knocking on the door. This time I will be as a guest, and I will go inside and give people permits to go through checkpoints and medicine. And in return, I will hear their stories about what it is to live under a military occupation. And during this time, I meet countless women with breast cancer in Palestine. The number is unknown to anybody because there's nobody taking track. But during this time, my mother is dying back home and I can see the exact same things going on. And my mind just going wider and wider. During this time, I'm hearing about a little group called Breaking the Silence, a young group of veteran soldiers, combat soldiers, that collecting testimonies from other soldiers across the West Bank and publish it into the Israeli public and international people. What is the truth inside these occupied territories? And I decided I want to tell my story, my mother's story, this woman's story. And I'm starting to give them stories from inside the army. And the day I released from the army, I joined Breaking the Silence. And for the next 2.5 years, I will become their chief investigator. We'll take testimonies from more than 250 soldiers from the West Bank and Gaza, and we'll try to publish it into the Israeli public and abroad. And I know that the occupation is that close to be ended with, because the people of Israel didn't hear my story yet. And after they hear my story, the occupation will have to drop, right? But a few months go by and nothing changed, and the testimonies that I'm collecting doesn't do anything. And then Operation Kesled started. And Operation Kesled was so bad. We sat back at home and tried to understand what's going on, but nobody told us what's going on down in Gaza. So I'm finding myself going from Breaking the Silence office into the border with Gaza, just stand there outside of the border, waiting for soldiers to go out of the operation to tell me what was going on inside. And after 3 weeks, soldiers are starting to come out from Gaza. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them will pass through me and will tell me their stories. And they were very, very confused. A lot of people think they were very mad or very happy in Operation Kesled, but they weren't. They were very confused because those soldiers were training for years and months to be handling a war. And they got their war when they got to Gaza. They saw tank shells just bombing everything in sight for them. They saw Air Force, the Israeli Air Force, just dropping ton bombs on civilians, clearing the path for them to go in. They saw white phosphorus falling from the sky, burning everything it touches along the way. But until it was their time to go by foot into Gaza, there was no enemy left. Just hundreds of hundreds of hundreds of dead bodies around them every day of the operation. And they came out very confused. And in the next 3 months, I will collect testimonies from everyone I can that serve inside Gaza during this time. And we'll put a booklet down of Breaking the Silence, a booklet of testimonies from Operation Kesled. But before we're going out with it to the Israeli public, we want to make sure this time we have a good platform so people will listen. It's important enough. So we're going to the most lefty newspaper in Israel. What is the most lefty newspaper in Israel? Haaretz. Everybody knows Haaretz all the time. It's weird. Yeah, so we're turning to Haaretz. And I'm talking with Amos Salel, the military reporter of Haaretz, and I'm telling him the stories, and he's saying, whoa, if this story is true, you guys are getting a cover story. And he's verifying the stories for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, he's saying, it's going to come out this Friday. And all of us on Friday go out to the stores and buy all the hours we can. But there is no cover story. And there is no backstory or middle story. So we're going back to the office and we're calling the Alex auditorium and saying, what happened? And they will explain to us, basically, yesterday we got a phone call from the IDF spokesman. And the IDF spokesman gave us two options. Or you're going with Breaking the Silence, or you're going with me. But if you're going with Breaking the Silence, I'm not working with you anymore. And the Haaretz editorial is continuing to explain to us and saying, you know, we don't really have investigative reporters in Gaza or in the West Bank, except for maybe Amir Haas. So we really rely on the IDF spokesman to give us the truth from these territories. And I'm hanging up the phone, and I'm flipping through the book that the Israeli public will not read anymore. But then I noticed there's holes in the stories. There's a few stories in the booklet, our booklet, that's missing completely. And there's a few booklets with holes in the middle of them. So I'm going to my boss at the time, Yehuda, and I'm saying, what is going on? There's holes in the story. And he said, oh, that's fine, that's fine. This is only what the IDF censorship took down. And I'm saying, what? I said, oh, come on, man, don't be naive. You know that every news channel in Israel, every TV channel, every radio station, every blogger on the internet or newspaper have to go through the IDF censorship, right? I'm saying, no, I didn't know that. We don't have free press. This is amazing. But wait. We're breaking the silence, right? We're breaking the silence. And Yehuda is looking at me and saying, oh yeah, we're breaking this silence that the idea of censorship allows us to break. And I understand that my days in the organization is numbered. And after a few months, I will go out for breaking the silence. I will continue to do the same kind of work, only by my own. I will collect testimonies from soldiers, from officers. I will collect stories from people outside of the army, the biggest officials inside the military and security industry in Israel. Collect their stories and get it back, instead of breaking the silence, to the reporters of the Times, to the Guardian, a lot of the story, to the Washington Post, to BBC. I will start to press the, send the stories outside, and they will publish. Not fully, but a lot of them will publish outside. And during this time, I'm discovering something pretty amazing. The more I go in looking for occupation, the more I find money. And I don't understand, so I'm going deeper and deeper. And then in 2010, I'm getting into a very interesting story about how the Israeli government and Israeli army was selling a new tear gas canister into the government of police, the police and government of Singapore people. They're selling tear gas canister to fight their protests in their country. And during this time, I'm looking and I'm saying, Israel is selling tear gas canister? So I'm going to into the website of the Minister of Security in Israel, and I find out they're saying that Israel just concluded a deal with the Singapore government of selling the best tear gas canister ever produced and tried by the Israeli army. And it was mentioned there a few lines later that this tear gas canister was proven to be the most deadliest ever. And I'm going back and I'm saying, wait, try the tear gas canister. Who would be agreed to be tried? And then I understand. They're trying the weapons every day. Not in labs, down there on the field. They're trying their weapons. I was trying their weapons in Bilin, in Yalin, in Fakadum, in Abi Salah, in Bethlehem, in Hebron. El Halil, South Mar Chevron, in East Jerusalem. We're trying the weapons every day, and then we're selling it outside. And I couldn't believe the things that I'm seeing, so I'm going deeper and deeper. And then I realized that, you remember this guy, the young guy that threw stones in the beginning of the protest? They were not Palestinians. They were actually an undercover unit of the Israeli army, looking like me, Arab Jews, disguising as Palestinian inside these villages, starting a riot, starting something, so the Israeli army will have a good excuse to start shooting the place up and testing the weapons. And the more I go, the more I can understand, is this for real? How long is it going through? How much money are we making? I'm going in and in, and then I discovered in the last 40 years, and this is a very, very partial list, this is the dictatorships and regime that the Israeli government and the Israeli army is trading weapons with, trading knowledge with, trading technology, or training their soldier by themselves in those countries. In the last 40 years, we were involved in the worst dictatorships and regimes in the world. And we were making a killing out of it, literally. We're making so much money out of it. And then I understand. This is not an occupation. It's a laboratory. Sometimes as a soldier, I would infuse poison to Palestinians. Sometimes as a protester, I will run away with Palestinians and be in a lab rat. But all this time, we're trying weapons out and selling them out there. In the source of everything, it's not the religion, it's not the land. There's a lot of money. And I understand that I'm standing in the wrong place. And I'm moving to New York City from Jerusalem. It's a big change. And I'm standing in New York City, and the last 3 years, I'm researching the relationship between our army and your army, our government and your government, and all the money that flows in the middle. Now I'm gonna do a cut just for a second and do a different ending than usual. We're doing it in the last few lectures, and I wanna try it now. 2.5 months ago, we were on the Maryland Highway on our way to do this kind of lectures in Washington, D.C. And we were on our way, we crashed our car in the middle of the Maryland Highway. We were stuck in the middle of the highway. People were driving next to us, and we did something we don't really like to do. We called the police. And the police came very fast, very efficient. The Maryland officer police came and took us out of the highway. Tall car came and took my and another friend with our car to the lot. And I got a ride along with the Maryland officer police. And for 10 minutes, we're driving silently, and I have no idea it's going to change my life, this ride. And we're driving quietly, and then the guy is looking at me, the officer of the Maryland Police is looking at me and saying, so, where are you from? And I'm saying, oh, I'm from Israel. And the officer said, oh man, you guys are bad asses. You know how to silence the one that opposed you. You know how to calm them down. Nobody disobey you. You guys are the best. And I'm saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't think you really know a lot about the Israeli army. So, you know, never mind. He said, oh, no, no. I just came back from there. I'm saying, what, is a tourist? I'm saying, no, with the Maryland police. We just came back from training with your military and your police. I'm saying, what? Said, oh yeah, you know, all of our police here in the U.S. is going to a few weeks to Israel and train with your army and your police. And I'm still starting investigating more and more, getting more information out there. And then before I leave the house, his car to the lot, I'm thinking, is there a chance you know Shlomo Efrati, my father, the head of investigation of the Jerusalem police? And the guy takes out his cell phone and flipping pictures. And he got a picture hugged with my dad in the middle of the night in Washington, D.C. And I'm just blown away. I'm going out of the car and I'm calling my dad in Jerusalem. And I'm saying, Dad, what the hell? And my dad is telling me, oh, come on, Irani, don't be naive. You know NYPD got an office in Tel Aviv, right? You know we got an office in New York, right? Come on, we're working together to protect you.
We'll continue with part three on our next program, and it gets more and more interesting as we get into it. Also, tomorrow, we will be having our next to last meeting of our health support group. 3 months is just about here and gone, and I'm looking forward to hearing people's input, 3 to 6 o'clock. It's only open for people already in the group, and this group meets tomorrow, and then in 2 weeks, and that wraps it up, and then I'll share the results with the audience. We have to have an outside independent medical biostatistician do a review of all the statistics and the journals and come up with what the good findings were. And if people don't believe that the internet is the future of media, then they haven't been paying attention. There are hundreds or thousands of outstanding radio personalities throughout the decades who one day they no longer have a place on the air. Maybe the ratings weren't right. Maybe there was a new regime came in and wanted to bring in their own programs. Whatever the reason, they lose their job. Not easy to find another one. And also you have enormous amount of politics and ideology that controls programming. So I started to look around to see some of the people who hadn't been on the air for 5, 10, 15 years. And I found some outstanding ones. And there are now, we have 15 new programs starting on Progressive Radio Network starting this weekend and then added. But I want to just give you two examples of people that weren't on radio. One hadn't been on radio in 12 years and now is one of the highest rated listened to radio programs in the world over the internet, dwarfing what she used to on WBI, and that's Utrecht Lead, following my program each day at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. If you look at the audience she used to have on BI at her highest numbers, and you look at her numbers now, they're not even in the same universe. Danny Schechter was another outstanding journalist, but there was no place for Danny. He couldn't get himself on anywhere. Well, we put him on Progressive Radio Network and had a tremendous audience. Lots of people listened, downloaded the show, thousands and thousands per week. So the future is the internet. And I hope the good people over at BAI understand that station's going to be sold through bankruptcy, in my opinion. But have a plan B. Look at the internet. And a group of you get together and put together what you believe would be an ideal group of voices and include a lot of young and diverse ones, not just those on politics and ideology, because that's one of the reasons you've lost 95% of the station's audience. You over-politicized it. And it was way too disconnected from what people's actual needs are. Get real with what people need. Remember, you're going to succeed in the media if you match your message with people's needs. There's a good harmonization there. Now, I want to say hello to Christopher because he has something to say about ADHD. Hi, Christopher from New York. Your turn.
Hello, Gary. Love the show. I suffer from adult ADHD as well as my best friend. I've learned that it makes my life, my practical life, hell. And I suffer from low attention span, difficult to engage with conversation, listening. And I used to take Strattera when I was a kid, but now I'm off all pharmaceuticals. Now I'm just eating. I'm a vegetarian now, and I've seen some improvement. But I believe holistic means is the way to go, and I preach this to all my friends and anyone that is willing to listen. Because I see the dangers of the pharmaceutical industry and the poisons they put in their medicine.
Well, I would suggest two things. Instead of giving yourself a diagnosis or accepting the diagnosis you've been given, simply say that you are facing life issues, that at that moment you were facing them, you were not prepared, you did not have the tools you needed, you were not in alignment with the system that could help you understand the information and stimulation and how to respond to it appropriately. The idea is now to get yourself aligned with people and movements that can take your interest, take what you find important, take what you will find an interest to your attention span, and then realign it that way, because otherwise you're going to always think that you're a disease, and we are far more important than our disease diagnosis. We are far more important than our careers, even our relationships. And often we sacrifice our true identity, the true meaning of our life, to what someone who has some authority in some degree has told us we are, without knowing anything about us, with the most superficial information. So good for you for getting off the meds. But very shortly, when I come back to New York, which will be in a couple weeks, I'm going to be starting a three-month, as I promised over 6 months ago, I'm going to start a three-month just on ADD and ADHD, people who have been diagnosed with it, and show you how you can rebalance your perception and no need to rebalance the brain. Okay? All the best to you, Christopher. And we're out of time. I'm going to thank you all for listening. Got a busy weekend ahead, and with the upcoming events, including the 9/11 series that will be with Danny Sheehan, William Pepper, and presidents, the president of Italy's Supreme Court, and Richard Gage, and many others at Cooper Union from 10 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday this weekend. So a lot of people are going to be there. And then I'll be doing a 7-hour special starting Sunday evening, 6 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.